Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast, your source for policy rants and raves, but mostly rants from Tech Freedom, your Washington, D.C. advocate for the freedom to tinker and innovate. I'm Evan Schwartzschreiber, your host. On today's show, what does the passing of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia have to do with net neutrality? And what will it mean for the outcome of the litigation over the FCC's internet regulations? Joining me in our DC studio to discuss this is someone who will never be confirmed to the Supreme Court, President of Tech Freedom, Baron Soka. Baron, thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Evan.
So last Saturday, Supreme Court Justice Scalia passed away, and it sparked a flurry of media coverage, including thoughtful tributes, partisan jabs, and speculation about the future. Now, Baron, before we delve into the issue of net neutrality, you are a lawyer. You're a believer in the Constitution. What did Justice Scalia mean to you?
Well, I didn't always agree with him. Justice Scalia, I have to say, was not, in substantive terms, my favorite justice on the court. I could pick a number of his decisions that I would disagree with pretty strongly, most notably his decision in the Raich case about medical marijuana, where he and Justice Thomas parted ways very sharply. Justice Thomas upheld the rights of states to decide on medical marijuana for themselves. Justice Scalia did not, and was criticized by many, including myself, as really betraying the originalism that he purported to implement. But it must be said, and I think anybody who disagrees with him about any number of things, whether it's 5% of what he said or 100% of what he said, would have to acknowledge that he was far and away the best writer on the court, the most entertaining justice, and indeed, in my opinion, really one of the best writers and wits in the English language today. You can't go through law school without developing a certain appreciation for his work, and I would just encourage everyone to read it, think about it, and also think about the cases where he really did come out in quite surprising places.
Yeah, he really did change the parameters of debate on the court. As you said, his originalism, his view that the Constitution should be interpreted as it was written and what the framers had in mind when they were writing it, that's really had an influence on justices who don't really ascribe to that view. You see some of the more left-leaning judges using originalist arguments to try to undermine the Second Amendment. And I forget who said it, but someone really summed up his impact on the court by saying, "We're all originalists now." You know, whether you believe the Constitution should be interpreted as it was written or whether it's a living document, you have really been influenced by his time on the court.
Well, indeed. I would just point out that he and Justice Thomas are both called originalists. They actually have very different views, and it comes down to whether you look just at the words on the page and try to look at their definition at the time, or whether you have a broader understanding of original meaning. But I do want to just say Justice Scalia deserves a lot of credit for some surprising things. He was pretty widely known as the criminal justice defendant's best friend. He pushed the envelope on Sixth Amendment rights of confronting a witness and so on. But also, perhaps more surprisingly, he was often thought of as being a defender of the imperial presidency, but actually on some of the most important cases, he voted the other way. And I would just very, very briefly point you there to the issue of indefinite detention. That's something we've talked about how long you can hold American citizens without trial. It's been a major issue lurking under the surface in the Republican debates, where Ted Cruz and Rand Paul voted against the defense bills for that reason, and Jeb and Marco have been attacking them for it. And Justice Scalia said about that something that I think is quite relevant to tech policy generally, which was that, quote, "If civil rights are to be curtailed during wartime, it must be done openly and democratically, as the Constitution requires, rather than by silent erosion through an opinion of this court." That decision in Hamdi versus Rumsfeld, you could use that same text again today to talk about the Apple case involving the FBI and their attempt to really erode the security of devices slowly and by silent erosion by the courts. So Justice Scalia really offers a wealth of not just wit and genius in his writing, but also some committed civil libertarian perspectives that I think people across the political spectrum might be surprised by.
And today there will be a viewing at the Supreme Court for people who would like to go pay their respects. So Baron, right now we've got 8 Supreme Court justices on a 9 justice court. And what does this mean for the court just procedurally?
Yeah, in general, it means that, for example, our case that we're filing right now about Apple and the unlocking of that phone out in California, that may very well work its way up to the Supreme Court. It will probably go first through the magistrate and then to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit might, we would hope, rule in our favor. And if that happens, and it goes up to a divided 4-4 court, and if the court deadlocks, then it means that the Ninth Circuit decision stands. So in other words, across the board, whatever is the last decision to go up to the court will stand, but it will not bind any other circuit. So in the Apple case, the FBI could just go to another circuit and try to get another outcome if the Supreme Court just leaves something in place.
So while lower courts and their decisions are going to be given more weight, those decisions are not going to be able to be applied across the country. So there's going to be an interesting dynamic where you have a lot of 4-4 decisions being kicked down to the lower court and then not a lot of clarity for what's going to happen to the rest of the country until the vacancy is filled.
And I can tell you right now, there's no way that vacancy is going to be filled until the next president's term. So really, it typically takes about 3 months from the time of nomination. So if someone comes into office and makes a nomination very quickly, you could see a new nominee taking his or her seat by May of 2017, which really means that they wouldn't start hearing cases until the fall. So we have a long time to go here.
So let's talk about Justice Scalia's history with net neutrality. Proponents of utility-style regulation of the internet have long considered Scalia their friend on this issue, and this goes back to a case called Brand X, where in his dissent, Scalia said that there's no way you can interpret broadband as not a telecommunication service, as not a common carrier. Barron, are some of the left-wing activists who support strict regulation of the internet, are they right to consider Scalia their friend on that issue?
Yeah, well, first of all, we should step back and understand that Justice Scalia worked in the White House in the Nixon administration and worked on this specific issue at a time when, as we've discussed before, cable was essentially unregulated and the FCC was going through all kinds of legal contortions to figure out how to regulate it. And he was of the view at the time that the FCC should just use the authority that it had. And you saw that come across in a way in Brand X. Remember that the 1996 Telecom Act had left rather unclear what was the status of broadband. Was it a Title II common carrier, or was it a Title I information service? The FCC said in 2002 that cable modem service was a Title I, lightly regulated information service. The FCC was challenged. The case went through the Ninth Circuit, and it went up to the court, and the court ruled in favor of the FCC, saying that the FCC had the discretion to regulate down, to say that it was a Title I service. And that led the FCC that year to make the same decision about DSL telephone broadband. Now, what you're referring to is Scalia's dissent. He led a four-justice dissent where he said, and this is another great example of Scalia's amazing writing, even if you disagree with him, he said, quote, "After all is said and done, after all the regulatory cant has been translated and the smoke of agency expertise blown away, it remains perfectly clear that someone who sells cable modem service is, quote, offering telecommunications. For that reason, I would affirm the Court of Appeals." So that is specifically what people point to when they say that Justice Scalia would have upheld the FCC's undoing of the decision it made back in 2002 and deciding to regulate back up again and subject broadband to Title II.
Yeah, when the FCC originally put broadband in the Title I bucket as an information service, that was consistent with Congress and what the president wanted at the time. President Clinton and President Bush, they wanted a lightly regulated internet. They wanted the internet to be unencumbered by strict federal and state regulation. And when the FCC changed course, a lot of the proponents of strict internet regulation really thought that they had kind of a slam dunk in Scalia, because when and if the case finally made it to the Supreme Court, you would have Scalia joining with the liberal justices to uphold the FCC's strict regulation of the internet. But these aren't exactly the same cases, Barron. Can you explain for our listeners why Scalia's dissent in Brand X would not necessarily mean he would vote for the FCC's reclassification of broadband under utility regulations?
Yeah, I think there are two big differences. So the first difference is we're not actually talking about subjecting exactly the same thing to Title II. In the Brand X case, The issue was the last mile part of broadband networks. And remember that the issue that really had driven the FCC to regulate down to say that, that first cable and then telephone services were subject to Title I, not Title II, was that the most controversial part of traditional common carriage regulation was the requirement that you unbundle the last mile of your network.
And that last mile of the network is the pipe that goes to the home.
Right. And the idea, and we've discussed this in our show about the anniversary of the 96 Act, the idea was that that's how it was thought you were going to get competition. That's what the 1996 Act did to create competition for telephony. Now, it turns out we ended up getting facilities-based competition where cable and internet services and then wireless directly competed with telephone service. That's the kind of thing the FCC was trying to do with broadband. But the point is that in the Brand X case, they were talking about the last mile of the network. The FCC could have done that here. That would have been a relatively moderate form of reclassification. But they didn't do that. They said in the case that we're talking about, in the open internet order that was issued a year ago, they said, in fact, that the entirety of broadband service is subject to Title II. And that's a very important difference because what Scalia was saying was subject to Title II, or should be, would not really have gotten the FCC what it wants in this case. They would not have been able to do things like banning paid prioritization under the Scalia view, because this is the key point. Scalia was essentially saying, look, if it's a dumb pipe, it's subject to Title II. But he was talking about the part that happens after the what is called computer processing on the network. That's the very issue in this case. The FCC is trying to say that that is a Title II service, even though that pretty clearly, to our mind, meets the definition of information service because it involves processing of data. That's what prioritization means. That's what happens on the network. So that's the first reason why Justice Scalia was talking about something very different, and I think he would have had a very different analysis of the FCC's actual reclassification.
Yeah, just to summarize, what Scalia was dealing with in the Brand X case was the last mile that goes to your home. And if that is treated, if that is a dumb pipe and network management decisions like traffic being prioritized over other traffic, that's not happening on the last mile. So that last mile being classified as a dumb pipe and telecommunications, that is a completely different animal than what the FCC did recently, which is to declare the entire broadband ecosystem as common carriers, which then prevents service providers from differentiating their network traffic. So the activists who thought that Scalia was their friend on that issue are ignoring the fact that the two cases are just not the same.
Yeah, and Scalia was a sharp enough thinker to have seen through that kind of confusion. But there's a second reason I think that Scalia would have come out very differently on this case, and that I think the remaining justices still will, which is here, the issue again is it's regulating up. It's the FCC saying we're going to subject all of broadband service, cable and telephone service and wireless service to Title II. And by the way, we kind of acknowledge that that it's not a good fit. And so we, at the same time that we make that legal change, we are going to grant blanket forbearance. We're going to, across the board, edit down Title II to create kind of Title II light.
Right. So the FCC acknowledges that a 1934 law is not necessarily entirely appropriate for broadband, but what they'll do is they'll use their discretion to say, okay, these are the parts we want and these are the parts we don't want. And that creates a problem because those promises are only as good as the current FCC chairman and the current administration. And there's no regulatory certainty if all of Title II is always potentially usable, and all that a company can do is just hope that that current FCC chairman picks the parts that allow for investment and innovation.
Right. Which is why I would say that if Scalia were looking at this again, I think it's become much more clear if you look at his more recent decisions that he would have asked the question not is Title II light reasonable, but is all of Title II reasonable? And in that respect, I think there are two lines of decisions that he either wrote or signed on to in recent years that would suggest that the court would come out very differently here. And basically, they boil down to, number one, the court having said in a number of cases, most notably Brown and Williamson, and then again in the Obamacare case, King v. Burwell, that sometimes there are major questions that simply lie outside the boundaries of Chevron deference, because
just to explain quickly what Chevron deference is.
I was about to do that.
Oh, go ahead, Baron.
That's what the Brand X case was all about. The court essentially was saying, we don't know what the right answer is, but we defer to the agency about the best way to read it. And in fact, if you read carefully, what Scalia was actually saying there was, in fact, he didn't defer to the agency. He thought that that there was only one way to read the text. The point is that there's that line of cases. Is it a major question? How significant is the issue? The court has repeatedly decided cases on those grounds. And then there's a related line of cases that Justice Scalia most recently wrote in what I think might become one of his most important decisions, which was a challenge to the Obama EPA's clean air rules that attempted to regulate carbon emissions. And the long and short of that case essentially is that the EPA recognized that applying the old statute would have led to absurd results, just like here in the Open Internet Order case. And that's why they said they needed to tailor and modernize the case, just like here. And so they essentially rewrote the EPA's act. And Justice Scalia, in response, said that an agency may not rewrite clear statutory terms to suit its own sense of how the statute should operate. And here's that wit again. He says, we are not willing to stand on the dock and wave goodbye as the EPA embarks on a multi-year voyage of discovery. And I think that you can make the same argument here about what the FCC is doing, that it is essentially rewriting the dock, embarking on some long voyage of trying to create essentially a new Communications Act. And I don't think that's something that Justice Scalia really would have been okay with. And I think it's really astonishing to me that the FCC has been so blind to the analogy between these cases that they, in the Open Internet Order, they use the term modernize and tailor dozens of times. And they do this even after this Supreme Court decision that I just mentioned came out. They really did not think about this. And I think this issue is going to have to go up to the court, and it may well be the grounds on which the court decides the case.
Yeah, the link between the net neutrality case and the case over environmental protections is just agency discretion. When there's ambiguity in the law, how far can a regulatory body go in interpreting the ambiguity and saying that it gives them unique powers that Congress might not have intended? Now, Scalia has a history with net neutrality, as we talked about in the Brand X case. But we've got an op-ed out today that deals with the successor and how the likely successor to Scalia is going to impact the net neutrality case. That op-ed is on Real Clear Technology. You can find it, and we'll link to it in the show notes. But Baron, Sri Srinivasan, he's the most likely successor to Scalia. He was the Deputy Solicitor General. He was appointed to the D.C. Circuit in 2012, and he was confirmed by the Senate 97-0. So is he the perfect moderate to kind of box Republicans into a corner?
Well, that's exactly why I think he's topped the list of potential nominees. And I'll be a little bit surprised if he's not the nominee. We could see that decision come out as early as Monday, given the president's promise to wait until after the Senate came back into session. So there are a lot of reasons why the president might pick him. He said things like, for example, after the D.C. Circuit flipped and became really a Democratic court after having been in Republican control for many years, he tried to assuage concerns that this might change the court. And he said, quote, if we lived in a world where we had the rule of a judge rather than the rule of law, you would have seen an absolute sea change, an evulsive change in the law as it was interpreted, applied, and rendered by our court. And he would argue that you didn't see that from the D.C. Circuit. So he certainly tries to strike the kind of moderate tone the president is going to be looking for. What I say in this op-ed today is that the issue the for him, and maybe a reason actually to nominate him, is the net neutrality case. He's one of the three judges who heard oral arguments in this case in December. His decision is expected to come down in the next few months, and it's going to be out in time, I think, for any confirmation hearings if the Senate does in fact hold them. And the question is, how might he rule? And my thesis essentially is he could take a pass. He could rule that the FCC simply failed on procedural grounds and that they should have issued a new notice of proposed rulemaking after they changed course, after they did what the president told them to do and decided to use Title II. And if he does that, that's kind of a nothing burger. It doesn't really change much about his nomination. But if he votes either for or against the FCC clearly, it's going to make net neutrality a political football. We're going to get tied up. The two issues are going to get tied up together. And the question is going to be, does it help him or does it hurt him? And my thesis essentially is, if he votes to strike down the FCC's order, it makes him look that much more moderate. It makes Republicans look that much more obstructionist for opposing him. But here's the interesting thing. If he votes to uphold the FCC's order, I have no doubt that that helps him on the left. Of course, there'll be progressives who might criticize the nomination of a moderate, and that would certainly provide cover for the administration. But it also, I think, would trap Republicans into making his nomination a fight over net neutrality. And that's a fight that Republicans thus far, I think, seem destined to lose, because they haven't figured out that the issue really isn't net neutrality. It's really about the FCC claiming that broad sweeping authority to regulate, tax, and control the internet.
Yeah, we've seen Republicans mistakenly kind of hammer the amorphous concept of net neutrality, which we've talked about on the show means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Depending on how strictly you interpret net neutrality, zero rating programs like Binge On that T-Mobile offers, where they allow you to stream unlimited video in exchange for downgrading the quality, that type of arrangement could be illegal or legal under net neutrality, because it's a principle. It's not some set in stone idea that has specific facets. So clearly, Republicans make a strategic error when they just hammer away at this thing that can just be spun as a positive no matter how you slice it, where they really should be talking about the issue of internet regulation and the FCC's authority. So what you're suggesting is that no matter what, if he rules the way that Republicans want, that makes him that much more attractive for a confirmation hearing. If he rules against the FCC, that just makes him a darling of the left, which might otherwise oppose him for being a moderate. So this really is kind of the perfect win-win for the president. And I guess that's why we're seeing most court watchers suggest that he's
the likely nominee. You mean if he rules in favor of the FCC?
Right. If he upholds the net neutrality regulations and rules in favor of the FCC, that'll assuage concerns from the left that he's too moderate for the court.
Yeah. And so we'll see what happens. I mean, it's also worth pointing out that if he does get nominated, I don't think that nomination is going to go anywhere, but it's very likely that the next president, if it is a Democrat, would re-nominate him. And if he does wind up on the court, he's going to have to recuse himself, because the court would be reviewing a decision that he originally made. So this is the interesting procedural point about this. Before Justice Scalia's death, the plan for those of us who are challenging the FCC's order, which includes Tech Freedom, we're representing Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and investors who are concerned about the absolute ban on paid prioritization, the thing, again, the FCC felt it needed to do, and the reason that it didn't do what Scalia actually was talking about in Brand X, that more limited form of reclassification, we were all planning, I think, to get to the Supreme Court as quickly as possible, because the interim step of going to the full D.C. Circuit in what is called an en banc review really wouldn't have helped us. It's pretty likely that court, which is now mostly a Democratic court, would have ruled against us. But Scalia's death changes that, because if we lose here at the D.C. Circuit, either in whole or in part, we have every incentive to go first to the full D.C. Circuit instead of just the panel, just in order to make sure that when this case does go up to the Supreme Court, it goes up to a full court. The last thing we would want would be for the D.C. Circuit to rule against us and then have a 4-4 court deadlock, which would leave the D.C. Circuit down, court standing.
All right. Well, we'll certainly be tracking that issue. And listeners, you should be looking out for a decision from the D.C. Circuit sometime in May or June. But, you know, how these things are always uncertain. And
and probably not from the Supreme Court at this point until, at the earliest, I would say early 2018.
And certainly look out for net neutrality becoming an issue that comes up in the confirmation hearings, which would be really interesting for a tech policy issue to be so directly related to a national debate over replacing a Supreme Court justice. But that's it for today's show. My guest has been Baron Soka, who, like I said earlier, will never be a Supreme Court justice. Thank you, Baron, for joining us.
And you won't either, Evan.
Well, certainly not. Follow us on Twitter at Tech Freedom or on Facebook.com/Tech Freedom. Find this podcast in the iTunes store on your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will really help us out. And check out the op-ed we have in Real Clear Technology. It is linked to in the show notes of this episode. Thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.